Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Searcy Institute Podcast Network. I am David Kern, and as always on Close Reads, I am joined by Angelina Stanford and Tim McIntosh. Angelina, how's it going? Tim, how's it going?
It's going good, David.
Tim, you're in the throes of a play. Are you surviving?
I am seriously barely surviving. So we're doing Reader's Theater for the first five productions, and then we go into a full performance at the end of this month. This is February 1st, isn't it? Readers, do you guys know what Reader's Theater is, or a staged reading? Does that make any
are you familiar enough?
Okay. Yeah.
So tonight we're doing music stands on stage. The actors will not be moving around, and a few of the stage directions, she drops her tea mug, will be read during the dialogue. And we'll be doing it in costume, and there'll be a couple of sound cues. I mean, it's really, really scaled back, but it is overwhelming how much work it is. I forgot because the last time I've been on theater, somebody else has been doing all of the stage managing stuff, and I've just been acting. Man, it is such a massive task to put on a play. I forgot about what a massive task. And it also occurs to me how much detailed, fine grain work, like who is bringing the scarf to the show tonight? That stuff makes me so, it takes all of the energy out of my sails, but it's what I have to do now.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to hire a stage manager and pay her lot of money so that I
don't
have to think
about it. Why couldn't your stage manager be a dude?
Yeah, really, that was very sexist, Tim.
Thank
gosh,
you guys.
Just on a rant these days. No voting.
I'm
the scarves. Like, this
I'm
is
offended.
What I hear you saying about women.
I'm offended because, not because you're belittling women, but because I could be a good stage manager.
I was actually thinking that, David, when he was leading it up. That's why he shocked me with his choice of pronoun. I was like, clearly, out of the three of us, David is the stage manager.
You know, it's
funny. If you look to me and are like, Angelina, who's bringing the scarves? I'm going to be like, what scarves? I don't know what we're talking about.
So it's funny, as you were talking about that, I was thinking, I have a friend who is a producer for sporting events, like television sporting, he televises sporting events. So last night I went with him to a Wake Forest, Florida State college basketball game, and he's the producer of the show. So I went and watched him, went in the trailer and watched
that.
That sounds great.
Yeah, so I sat right behind the producer and the director as they were putting on this whole sporting event, and I was telling people at the office today, this is something like when I was a little kid, I wanted to do sports media. I wanted to work, either like a beat writer or be in broadcasting or something. So ever since I was 8 years old, I was fascinated by the way sports were televised. Like, how do they get the replays on? So I remember being 8 years old and trying to figure out all this stuff. So this was kind of something I was interested in as a kid. But you know how when you watch a sporting event and it's produced really well, you never notice it, right? You're
right.
Just they're giving me information on the screen now, right? Or they're showing this from a cool camera angle, and now I know everything.
You only notice when they blow it, you lingered on that cute girl in the audience, and I missed the shot.
Right,
yes,
exactly.
Yeah, right, right.
Or the, the score, they're telling scores from other games, and the score is wrong. But I was realizing, when I had a headset on, so I was listening to everything, and so I could hear the announcers and the producers and the directors and the statisticians and the graphics guys and the person behind me who was counting down the next, they had to get the next billboard up for the advertiser. And I was just thinking that these people are so good at what they do, and they make it look so easy. And it's piles upon piles of details.
Oh, and, man, I bet.
Probably similar to what you're describing, where,
In real time. That's amazing.
Yeah, live. Yeah. I mean, they do it over and over. And so they get to, in a sense, they're rehearsing and they're practicing and they everybody does their job, right?
Yeah.
You know what your job is. Like the play by play and the color commentators, they know their job. And not everybody's talking to them, but then my friend's the producer. So he's working with everybody and making it kind of move.
Yes.
It's pretty cool experience to see.
I bet that was cool.
That actually sounds really fascinating. Go ahead.
The first half of the game, I was confused, but I was like trying to learn the language and like figure out where everything was, because they have these monitors and there's like 30 of them and they all mean something different, from the replay monitors to the actual feed that's going out to the TVs to, you know, to the 7 different cameras that they have going all at the same time, and like, and where the director chooses what shot you're seeing on TV. And by the second half, I was starting to like, I had a sense of what was actually going on. And so then I could start trying to predict what shot the director was going to put on here and like what statistical storyline were they going to grab. And then like, it was interesting to see where the producer would tell the announcers, okay, in 1 minute, we're going to do this thing about how this guy's been struggling, but he's having a good game tonight. But I need my graphics. So the graphics had 1 minute to create a graphic that could go on the screen. And then the announcer had to know that was coming on there, and without ever having looked at it before, interpret the information on there correctly and give it to the audience, who of course is sitting there judging what the announcer is saying. So it was cool to hear see and hear all of it going on at one time. And I imagine you're going through the same thing right now.
Yeah.
In a similar way.
Yeah.
That's super cool.
One of the things that strikes me is that the people behind the camera, or in my case, behind the scenes, and the people that are on camera and on the stage, those skill sets are so different. Not that they can't overlap, but they are so different.
Yeah.
And the person who has to be able to communicate to both is the director and oftentimes the producer. They kind of have to, you know, you've got to be able to get an actor, in my case, to like, you know, like this is an emotional moment in the play, and you've got to help the actor reach that moment. And then you've got to go look at color swatches, you know, and
lighting,
like do technical lighting details. Exactly. And it's just keeping track of all of the details. I love looking at color swatches. I love fine tuning lighting. I love, more than anything, probably working with actors. But it's remembering scarves. That's the thing that I cannot do.
Title of your memoir. I love that.
The title of the memoir should be Forgetting Scarves.
Forgetting Scarves.
That would be more accurate.
So here's a funny little story then, since we have outed me as a former athlete. So when I watched a lot of sports as a kid, oh my goodness. You have no idea. Kept intricate stats of my favorite team. I had a box in my room. I can still to this day tell you the 1982 starting lineup of the Atlanta Braves. I mean, like, I was into it.
Good for you.
I can. But anyway, so I wanted to be the color commentator, which you can totally see that, right? Like, that was my dream job. I was going to be the color commentator, which, if our listeners don't know what that is, that you got two guys. Well, we don't really have one to do, but two guys talking about the game. And one is the play-by-play. He's literally describing what is happening. The color commentator is the guy that's going to tell the funny stories and the witty anecdotes and
analyze.
Yeah, he's going to give the sweeping narrative about what's going on. So he's going to be the more the big picture guy, the more entertaining one. He's usually got a catchphrase.
Boom. So. Like John Madden.
Angelina, you would be great at that.
So
thank you. I really feel like I could have been so good.
You would be great at that.
So one of the things that I was thinking about as I was watching this, and then as you were describing the, you know, you're both talking about this, is that people who are really good at what they do, that has an outward facing result, like something people can consume or enjoy or whatever, make it look so easy. And I was thinking about that in connection with this book a little bit, because because we are here to talk about Howard's End, Ian Forster's novel, for those of you who have not been joining us.
This is the first ever we've had banter that Matt Bianco is going to listen to.
I don't know. I'll tell him to listen. We'll see what he says. But they make it look so easy. And there's something about the way Forster writes that feels, that I can't decide if it feels easy or not. Like, it flows off his pen.
It feels breezy to me, yeah. Right? I don't know if that's the same thing as easy, but...
Yeah, like, I've been trying to decide, was he a writer? Like, does it feel to me like he was a writer who slaved over every sentence and, like, was sweating and, like, couldn't decide on words?
I've asked myself that, too. That's funny. We were both thinking about that then.
Or is he a writer for whom some of these, you know, longer passages, like describing somewhat poetically the geography of England and things like that, did that just flow out of him? Like, did he barely have to think about it? And I mean, I know every writer spends a lot of time editing and things like that. I there's a whole process to it, but I've been trying to figure out what it feels like his writing was like.
My guess is that he's not the kind of guy where we're going to have a story like where the editor really wrote the book, you know, like he had the idea, but the editor comes in there and like fixes it.
Yeah, probably not.
There's a lot of books like that. It doesn't feel like this book was a fight. Like, it just feels like it's his voice. To me, it just, I mean, of course, again, like you said, everybody, they make it easy if they're good, but this, it so much feels to me like just off the cuff observations, you know? I think that's why I like it so much.
Tim, how do you feel about that? What does his writing feel like to you? Tim?
Are you there? His little thing is blinking. Where is he?
It says he's muted. This is good radio.
I'm so sorry, you guys. I'm so sorry. I was trapped in a glass house yelling, calling for you, and you couldn't hear me.
I was throwing stones. I mean, I don't know why that didn't work.
I was like, I gave the most wonderful answer. It's like the best answer I've ever given on close read to you guys.
And of course, you won't be able to replicate it. We get it. Give it a shot, though.
I totally agree with Angelina. His style is breezy, is a great word. I thought earlier, it's kind of whimsical. And I have a feeling he's probably not like Flaubert, who apparently Madame Bovary just took eons to write, and Gustave Flaubert is sort of the name that everyone thinks of when they think of a painstaking craftsman who labors over every comma and who is just chiseling his masterpiece. It struck me that like Forster could probably, this struck me as he wrote it quickly.
Yes.
I
love your metaphor, right? So if Flaubert is chiseling, like, so he's in the stone and he's meticulously, you know, ticking away at that, then I feel like Ian Forster is like Jackson Pollock. He's just throwing buckets of paint on the canvas and boom, there it is, you know? Some arts scholar is going to jump all over me for characterizing Jackson Pollock like that, but that's my impression of that impression. There you go.
So you don't, there doesn't feel like this precision to it then? Is that true?
I don't know that I would say it's not precise. It just feels unlabored. Like, it just feels like it flows.
Yeah.
He's describing a world he knows, and these are people he knows. Like we've said before, the Schlegel sisters are based on people he knows, and that might be part of why it feels so flowy. Almost journalistic in a way. I don't know.
Do you have any examples?
I think Jackson Pollock is a really good allusion, because if you look at a Jackson Pollock painting, it's not as if it's unstructured. They're actually pretty structured. He will put down kind of like a baseline of black, let's say, and that kind of has a rhythmic structural quality in the painting. And it might just look like splashes, but there's something, at least to me, about Pollock's paintings that are very, that are harmonious if you can kind of dwell in them a little bit. And I think it fits Forster. It looks like he's splashed paint, but there is some structure underneath what's going on.
Yeah, but it's like not entirely traditional, because I know some of our readers are struggling with that on the Facebook page, you know, because this is not a typical novel structure. Not even now. I mean, we're in the postmodern age where everybody's messing with form, and we're not necessarily seeing this. This is different. And I wish I could remember what his other novels are like, and I can't. It's just been too long to remember if they're like this or not. I suspect they are. Because, again, it feels so Virginia Woolf as I'm reading this. And So it was probably just them all at the time.
Do you, Tim, do you still feel, now that we're through chapter 20, do you still feel like you're wondering what this book is about? Like, is that sense of that, I don't know if I would say it's a disconcerting sense, but just that feeling of non-direction or something. Is that still hovering over you?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we had a big moment in this reading. We had an engagement. Mm-hmm. You know, that's usually either the conclusion or the near conclusion of a book, or maybe it's the beginning of a book, but most often it's the conclusion of a book. And we have it, and it's a big one between, spoiler alert, Mr. Wilcox and Margaret. And it's almost in the direct middle of the book, mm-hmm. you know? And so in that way, it's another way in which he's more than just tinkering with the form. He's taken the bolts off the screws and is like putting together a different apparatus.
Is it, can we, if we were talking about the book using some of the traditional, structural elements, mm-hmm. Is there, could we identify where those elements show up so far? Like, do we have,
that's a great question.
It is a great question. I think we have a quest for home probably is the essential motif, right?
Well, I agree. There literally is a quest for a home.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't, do you think that he is, I don't know what the word is. I don't mean to say that he's like trying to be ironic or even do a send up or a satire, but
it's ironic.
She is literally looking for a home.
Yeah.
So do you think he is making a commentary on that narrative element? You know, that trope.
Okay. So I don't know if this entirely answers your question or not. Here's my sense, but like, and it speaks back to what Tim was saying, because we did have a big moment. We've had a death and now we've had an engagement. Like, mm-hmm. these are the two biggest moments in existence, right? And he doesn't milk them, and he pulls the camera away, if we're going to use that metaphor.
Just need a birth.
But
I know, exactly. I was going to say the same thing.
Exactly, right? You know? But I think in this section, we got much more of a sense of what he's doing. So he's been setting up Margaret's ideal world versus Mr. Wilcox's real world, right? Mm-hmm. And all these conversations about what's real, the inner life or the outer life. And Helen wants to live entirely in the inner life. And Meg says, no, there's something. Yes, I agree the inner life is the most valuable, but there's also something really good and valuable about the outer life. And she's, of course, very drawn to the Wilcoxes because of that. So when we look at the engagement and we look at Margaret's interior mind, okay, what is she thinking about it? I think that we understand now why Forrester is doing what he's doing with the narrative, right? Margaret wants the romance. She wants him to make the declaration. She wants him to kiss her, but lead up to the kiss and then give her mm-hmm. this moment. And then afterwards, let's talk about our feelings. And he's just like, boom, out of nowhere, kiss. And now on to the next, you know, business matter. And he just leaves her hanging, which is also what Ian Forrester is doing to us. We are all left hanging. You know, he's not letting us do what Margaret wants. He's not sweeping us up in this story. Like, this whole book has read like Mr. Wilcox's kiss. That's my thesis. There you go. Just out of nowhere, boom, and I'm off.
So, okay, I wanted to ask you about that. Do either of you think he kisses her like that in this kind of non-romantic way because he is feeling awkward? I'll just put it that way.
Well, Margaret makes the point that after they get to know each other, that's still who he is. He's not a romantic man. She says he's never going to open up to his emotions. This is mm-hmm. not who he is. Mm-hmm. She's not going to be the female character who gets him in touch with his feelings. That's not this story. She's not going to set him free to feel. This is not Jane Eyre in Rochester, right?
Like, is she even trying? Like, she's okay with him being how he is.
She totally accepts it.
Do you, we talked in the last episode about how it feels a little bit like Forrester is keeping us at arm's length from our characters. Do you, particularly Margaret and Helen to a certain extent, do we feel like we know Margaret better after this section than we did before? Like, as our kind of protagonist? Or is she still a mystery to us?
I feel like I'm getting to know her. Tim, how do you feel?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I know her a little better. And I like her more. I like her a lot more.
Hmm. There was an interesting line in chapter 16 where Leonard is, it's kind of from Leonard's perspective. And it says that he scarcely distinguished between the two sisters. One was more beautiful and more lively, but yeah. The Schlegel still remained a composite Indian god whose waving arms and contradictory speeches were the product of a single mind. And
that's so good.
And I marked in my margins that Forrester, even there, is keeping them at arm's length from us as individuals, right? Like, we aren't, Bast has helped, it's just as confused as we are, and yes. we're not learning anything new about them or coming to understand them as individual people, individual characters, yes. any more than he is as individual
yes.
people.
Yes. And we talked last time about whether or not Forrester's showing us something about the unknowability of another human being. And I think we see that with Margaret and Mr. Wilcox. Yeah. And Margaret's just sort of acceptance of, well, this is how much we're going to know each other. And that's good enough. Right. And then the same thing where I've previously felt like the Schlegel sisters might be treating Leonard a little bit like a project and not really like a person. But then in this scene, Leonard kind of does the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. They're just this goddess of multi arms. You know, they're not real people to him yet. And so because everybody seems to be viewing each other that way, I don't feel like he's pointing out character flaw, character flaw, character flaw, right? Like, this is just the mm-hmm. nature of human interactions is mm-hmm. where none of us are really understanding each other.
And that being said, Angelina, does that make you think that the quote about the only true thing, forgive me, I'm going to botch it, is one's kind of personal, emotional affections? Do you guys know what the quote that I'm talking about?
That was the quote that David started with from...
Yes, right.
Yeah, what was that? I don't remember.
Keats. It's an allusion to Keats. I am certain of nothing but the holiness of the heart's affections. But the quote from Forrester, for me, it's on page 155.
What chapter?
19. One is certain of nothing but the truth of one's emotions.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
I'm trying to find what, because there's a lot that's happening there.
There is.
That whole chapter...
I marked so many passages.
I wrote that this is nonsense, of course, as Margaret knows.
Yes, but Helen and Margaret are both comfortable accepting a certain amount of nonsense, and I feel like I relate to that. So.
Well, and because
this would not be problem. Like, to tell me something I believe is nonsense would seriously not be problematic to me. I would just look at you and grin to myself and think, that's so cute that you think I have to make sense.
Well,
operating on a whole other plane than you. Like, it just wouldn't bother me in the least.
It's, let me see if I can find a word from the list that is not interesting.
That doesn't interesting.
It's relevant.
How about fanciful, Angela? That was so fanciful. It was. Well,
it's relevant that you talk about making sense, because right below that line about nothing, one is certain of nothing but the truth of one's emotions, it says, it was, however, illogically the good, the beautiful, the true, as opposed to the respectable, the pretty, the adequate.
Yes.
I think you may have even...
I put that on Facebook.
Yeah. And then right below that...
Everyone can track my reading by following me on Facebook.
Right below that, it sharpened idealism, stirred the soul. It may have been a bad preparation for what followed.
Mm.
But... It isn't. I am fascinated. There's a word from the list that people provided for us. I am fascinated by this idea of people not knowing each other in this book, but also, I don't want to say using each other because I think it's a little harsh.
That is harsh.
But getting something from other people that they're looking to get, or that they need. So like Leonard gets out of the Schlegels. You know, there's that line that is pretty funny. He was itching to talk about books and make the most of his romantic hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're after something from each other.
Yeah,
there's some deep abiding need in them for something that is being fulfilled by other people, even though they don't like, they see that the person might be able to meet a need for them even if they don't know them, and so there's that struggle to get to know them and have that need fulfilled within this other person.
Well, that's really interesting to me for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, but do you mean interesting? Like, is it interesting? Like, you actually like it?
Like, no, I actually like it, like, and now spurred to thought, and I'm feeling excited in my heart and a bunch of other nonsensical emotions.
You are intrigued by my ideas and wish to subscribe to my newsletter.
I'm so intrigued. I don't subscribe to newsletters, nor do I listen to podcasts. So clearly I'm not a model for anyone. But it's such a fine line, right, about how people work in community, because there is a sense which you can go too far off the deep end and now you're using each other. But there's another sense in which that's exactly how God makes us, to be complementary, right? Like, so the love I freely give someone just happens to be the love that they need, right? And so I now experience joy because I have the joy of giving to someone something that they genuinely need. And then the model of that, of course, is the Trinity, three people who are loving each other and giving each other what they need, and no one's using each other, right? But that's a delicate tension. It's so easy, you know, in families, in marriages, in friendships, in work relationships, where somebody all of a sudden feels like we've gone askew a little bit, and now I'm being used, right? So it's a dance, really, right? But I can't help but think also of all the conversations we're having in this book about economics, and that it's sort of the same dance, if you kind of get my drift, right, between socialism mm-hmm. and capitalism, mm-hmm. right? In one sense, the economy should work in a way in which everybody's benefiting, right? People are giving, people are taking, and it's mutually beneficial for everyone. But then sometimes it falls out of skew, right? And so somebody's taking too much and someone's not giving enough. And so there've just been all these economic conversations, which also are essentially about how do you live in community in terms of the economy, right? So it's kind of, I feel like it's the same conversation across a variety of topics. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
That does make sense.
Yes.
You sound so surprised, Tim.
Well, no. Gosh, Angelina, that was stunningly insightful.
Much better. I like you so much better on a take two.
He didn't say shockingly insightful. Just he wasn't okay. shocked that you were insightful.
You're right. Okay.
The insight was just stunning.
Right. No, I think I. That's a very cogent explanation of this book. And believe me, I am still in the market for cogent explanations of this book.
This is my specialty, making sense of nonsense. Bring me more.
I shouldn't say that I'm like, last week I was really having trouble with it. I think that, like Margaret, is growing to accept Mr. Wilcox is a certain type of man, and she is going to accept it, not try to change him. I think I am learning to accept that E.M. Forster's book is a certain type of book, and I'm not going to hope for it to be another type.
Oh, that's really good. I like that.
Once I have made my peace with it, I'm beginning to enjoy it more.
Well, that's one of my absolute hills to die on, is that you have to honor the nature of a thing. I think it's taken us a little while to figure out what the nature of this thing is, but, you know, we're getting there.
I don't think I showed up wanting it to be a Jane Austen novel. I don't want to say that I came and I like was trying to like force it into some sort of pre-existent literary theory or archetype or something like that. I don't think I was doing that. I just didn't know what in the world we were reading, and I still don't know. But for some reason, it's been kind of easy to just get on the raft and float down the river. And that's what's happening right now. I'm floating down the river.
Well, good. There was a lot of river imagery here. So
yeah, there was.
Well,
very done. Fitting, right?
Very fitting. And no one asked me, but you know, if anybody wants to take a little heart check on where I am in my relationship with Mr. Forster, I'm ready to move this to the next level. Cause I
really,
I'm digging him so much. I can't even stop. Like, oh, there were so many lines that I just want to tattoo on myself. It's just ridiculous. Like right on my forehead, the line where he says, "You can either choose to look at the modern world steady or whole, but not both." And I was like, this is my daily struggle. I mean, that was so good.
That was a great line.
Oh, just such good insights. Like, I feel like the tension he's creating between the Wilcoxes and the Schlegels is the tension I live in every single day.
You know what I love about it is that he, I think through the mouth of Helen, gives real respect to the Wilcoxes. I mean, I think that he genuinely acknowledges that the Wilcoxes make the world go round.
Yes.
And they are kind of piggybacking on what the Wilcoxes
Yes.
Bring into it. I wish we could read that paragraph. I thought it was delightful. Yes.
Well, the one where Margaret essentially says, look, Helen, we wouldn't get to have this life of leisure and ideas and romance if the Wilcoxes of history did not make
Yes.
Britain, right?
I thought it was actually coming out of, begrudgingly, out of Helen's
was
mouth,
it?
But I probably
well,
miss, oh, I'd probably
well,
misremember.
Let's try to find that then, because yeah. I also really, really loved that. And that's, again, I love that he keeps holding these things in tension with one another. Like, it would be so easy to just bash the Wilcoxes as the modern man.
Right.
But he doesn't. And Margaret is very self-effacing with her own comments too, you know, just really willing to give honor where it's due and saying it's not a matter of, you know, the high-minded ideals that we carry as being the most important thing. You know, yes, I believe they're important, but the Wilcoxes are also important. Commerce is
yes.
important. Life is important. Men going to the army is important. Like, all of that is real. And if we did not have that, the world of ideas that we have the luxury and leisure to live in would not exist.
Right.
Well,
right.
That's what Helen, I think Helen, maybe Margaret, says to Leonard when they're kind of having their argument there. Because she says, what is the good of your stars and trees? Your sunrise and the wind, and this is in chapter 16, if they do not enter into our daily lives, they have never entered into mine, but into yours, we thought. Haven't we all to struggle against life's daily grayness, against pettiness, against mechanical cheerfulness, against suspicion? I struggle by remembering my friends. Others I have known by remembering some place, some beloved place or tree. We thought you one of these.
Mm-hmm.
David, who is that from?
That's from Margaret talking to Leonard in chapter 16. Mm. And so I find you use the word tension, and I find that that's a really compelling. No, that's well, it's a really compelling word to discuss the book big picture, because when we talk about narrative drive and plot and all that kind of stuff in fiction, there's always the question of like, what is the tension? What is this being trying? You're trying, the characters are trying to overcome or fight against or survive against or whatever it is. Like, what is the central tension that drives the narrative? And one of the things we've talked about is not much happens. And that is sort of true. But at the same time, there are what, half dozen or a dozen little tensions that are building up and bubbling up and keeping our narrative going forward. It's not like the narrative is stagnant. These tensions are moving it forward. And the epitaph at the beginning, or whatever you call it, is only connect, right? And so how people are connecting, and how these ideas are connecting, and how people are connecting to ideas, and how ideas are being interwoven into people's lives, that's where the tensions are. Because it's what, you know, people are striving for connection. And they're trying, there's all these different ways they're trying to do that. And some people are doing it successfully and some people are doing it unsuccessfully.
Yes.
And they're recognizing possibility in each other, but that's not always being met. The possibilities aren't always being fulfilled. And that's where the tensions are. And that's where our narrative thrust, our narrative drive, our narrative focus is. And so that's, I love that he doesn't have to, it doesn't have to be some big, climactic battle, so to speak. I'll use that word very broadly and generally. In these small moments of people trying to create connection either with themselves or find a connection with an idea that can be meaningful to them, that we get our story.
God, but I feel like I'm agreeing with everything you're saying, and it strikes me as you're talking about how deeply realistic that is. Like, and that's not a word you're gonna hear me throw around
yes.
much. But this is really what our lives are like. And yeah, we're going to have births and deaths and marriages and heartbreak and job loss. But mostly it's the day-to-day grind that we can't seem to wrap our heads around. It would be so much easier. Like I always say, it'd be so much easier just to be a martyr, right? It's like, boil me in oil. I will have an awesome last speech and that will be that, right? But this daily, where do I put the junk mail? Like this,
right. And
this
that's
is
why,
the stuff that I don't know how to handle.
And that's why Margaret is saying, what good is the sunrise and the wind and all that kind of stuff if it doesn't enter into our daily lives, if it doesn't give those things some kind of meaning or at least some context that they happen in that makes them
right.
That makes that,
and I feel like our particular audience is going to connect very strongly with this idea, because these are people who are at home living the daily grind
right.
of homeschooling, which, you know, and we do have our homeschool victories. We do have our epiphanies and our amazing moments and our Instagram photos, but mostly it's 11:30. Take off your pajamas.
No more screens.
Yes. Yes. No more screens. For the love of God, 5 minutes of reading. You know, that's what it's really like. You just, it feels like Sisyphus and you're just, you know, trying to roll this thing up. And
mostly we're trying to
feel glorious and grand.
Mostly, even in our homeschooling, we're trying to struggle against life's daily grayness, against pettiness, against mechanical cheerfulness, and against suspicion.
Yes.
Well, David, what's that from? Is that from our book? Yes. That was beautiful.
Thank you. Yes.
David's so breezy with his just off the head.
He's so whimsical.
He's so whimsical.
I'm gonna go ahead and draw a compliment for myself from the list. How about, you know, that's right.
Yeah. Did you write all these things down from the Facebook poll that was created for you?
Yeah,
Know That's Right is my favorite.
I got my iPhone open right here. You know,
I love
it. Son.
Every now and then it goes dim and I got to touch it so I can, you know.
Kudos to any of our listeners who get the reference that David and I just made. So boom, there you go.
Let's talk about, go ahead.
David, before we leave this subject, I have been thinking about Forrester's kind of view of relationships, and there's part, the word realistic that Angelina used is it's the exact right word. It's realistic. And I keep thinking about Margaret's relationship with Mr. Wilcox. She just relatively rapidly accepts his limitations. And I think it's a glimmer of hope that this relationship is actually going to be pretty functional. It might not have the great depth of the, you know, of the romantic stories of yore, but it's going to be very functional. It's going to work. And Margaret's even hopeful that love will bloom out of it. Mm-hmm. And I think about so many of the novels that we read and so many of the great stories, maybe Romeo and Juliet is kind of the tried example, where a deep and fundamental connection between lovers is held up and embraced as it's the thing that we all want. And Forrester's view is so, I'm going to say antithetical to that. I don't think that Forrester couldn't write a great romance. I think that he could, but I think his view, at least in this book, is that our personal feelings, our proclivities, our natures are so varied that what we really should be hoping for is to kind of bump into each other, connect. Maybe we separate, maybe we connect again. But I don't think that he is, this is what's confusing me a little bit. I don't think he's a capital R romantic, again, not in the 19th century, 18th mm-hmm. century sense, but in the true romantic love between the sexes is where salvation lies. I think he'd be like, that's a crock. Don't go, you know, that's not something you should be looking for, at least in this book. And so I've been having this little conversation with myself, like, well, what is, what's the right view? Like, I find capital R romantic books so satisfying. I also find this book to be profoundly realistic, and there's this kind of tension that's created in me, and I'm just kind of sitting with it for now. I wonder what you guys think about that.
Well, maybe you like the capital R romance. Like, maybe you feel it's so appealing because it's only realistic to a certain extent.
You mean it's limited and it's, what do you mean it's?
Well, I mean, you're saying that like you find the realism of the realisticness of this book and the way it presents romance to be, I don't know, what did you say? Compelling? I don't remember. What did you say?
Yeah.
But are profound. But that you long for the capital R romance that's maybe not as realistic, but maybe you long for the one that's not as realistic because it can provide something that is not available in the more realistic stories.
Uh-huh.
And so maybe there's a degree of catharsis or something you can get because it's not less profound, but it's perhaps just fulfilling something that is not universally, well, it's not necessarily, I don't know how to that's not realistic. I mean, I could go on and on about it, but I, for the sake of conversation, like, I think like that's a whole podcast conversation we could have just on that topic about why we prefer, like, why we prefer fantasy stories to, like, you know, works of realism.
To, novels about bureaucratic offices doing paperwork.
Well, okay, so it will come as a surprise to absolutely no one that I am both a capital R and a small R romantic. and just absolutely believe with everything that I am that, I mean, I'm a disciple of Charles Williams and the theology of romantic love. Like, this is not run of the mill thoughts for me. Like, I absolutely believe that romantic love is the union of two souls by which you enter into this mystery and can know God better. And I take that absolutely deathly serious and believe that it's soul transformative. And so I would never in a million years do what Margaret does. Like, Mr. Wilcox would get a kick in the teeth, you know, like, you just would never, ever have, would never be like, I can live with this. That would never happen. And yet I can appreciate what's being presented here. I can appreciate the same idea as we need the Wilcoxes for the world to move. And we need these kinds of marriages for the world to move. And it's not going to be for the Helens of the world. And it's not going to be for the Angelitas of the world. But God bless you, Margaret. You know, but then, okay, so we don't get the grand romance. But even then, he gives us this line, which gave me a little bit of hope. This line is in chapter 20. Mm-hmm. Love was so unlike the article served up in books. The joy, though genuine, was different. The mystery, an unexpected mystery. So I liked that in the sense that there is a mystery they're entering here. Might not
and
be
she
the one
knows
she
it.
Expected. Yes.
Yeah, she knows it, and she has already accepted it. It's so funny because it seems to me like so many, now we're talking about like my life, but I've seen so many relationships, and you guys have seen this too. The big romances start off fireworks, ba-boom, thunder in the background, light on the horizon. And inevitably there comes a time where the real personality set in, the real, you know, like the romance of asks is taken off, and your two real people are looking at each other and recognizing, oh, I had a glorified image of you, and now I'm either going to accept you for what you are, and you're going to accept me for what I am, or we're doomed. And it seems like Margaret got to that place before she got to, without having the fireworks with the thunder on the horizon.
Well, there's that, in chapter 19, there's the conversation between she and Helen, where Helen's basically saying, you shouldn't do this. And Margaret says, I don't intend him or any man or any woman to be all my life. Good heavens, no. There are heaps of things in me that he doesn't.
Yeah, talking about an anti-romantic speech.
Yeah.
Is it anti-romantic, or is she, I mean, in some ways, couldn't you say that it is romantic for her to say, we're limited in our ability to get to know each other. I'm never going to know everything about him. He's never going to know everything about me, but we're going to be committed to each other, and we're going to have this relationship, and we're going to do our best. Like, that's not an unromantic perspective.
Well, no, it depends what your terms are. I'm talking about romantic, like a certain philosophical ideal.
Okay. Okay. Like, okay. Yeah.
Personally, something I find, you know,
that's where we were using
gushy, you know,
R, lowercase R.
Using it in the philosophical sense, you know. She's not looking for someone to complete her. Mr. Wilcox is not her soulmate. This is a very, it's going to be what it is, and it's going to be good, and I'm happy
marriage
about it.
Marriage was to alter her fortunes, not her character.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Neither one of these people's on a rescue mission. You know, I think she really appreciates that Mr. Wilcox is capable, and I think Mr. Wilcox appreciates that it's about her that she's capable.
So what is she, I mean, are they after... There's the line about the fortunes, which I thought was really interesting. Are they after, what are they after with each other? I mean, is she after companionship? Is he out, you know, as a widower, is he after companionship? Is that the primary thing that brings them together?
I thought he was after companionship. Is that not how y'all read that?
I read it that way.
Is that consistent with what you're saying there, Angelina? It felt a little bit like you were.
I'm not sure how that's inconsistent. A companionship is not exactly a capital R romantic ideal.
Right.
He doesn't want to like merge with her soul. He just wants someone to have tea with. You know? I think I made Tim speeches in this episode.
Oh my gosh, it was so great. That's got to show up on the Facebook page. It's like, that's going to be like an all-time quote. The only reason it might not show up on the Facebook page is because the intonation merged with her soul. He wants somebody to have tea with. That was great. That was so great.
That I don't even know if I agree with that, honestly. Like, I don't know.
You don't know if that's what Mr. Wilcox.
I don't know if he doesn't entirely want that. Like, I don't think that. I mean, now there's a difference between what does he want? Like, what am I seeing in him as a character, and what do I think he's saying? Like, the book's not. I don't think the book is saying that he wants to merge with her soul.
And Margaret doesn't seem to think that's what's going to happen. That's how I'm reading it from her. Like, you know, when she thinks about what will this be, and am I okay with what this is?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, now I'm not saying this is wrong, okay, because it's actually quite true, but it's a very anti-capital R romantic thing for her to say there are going to be parts of him always that I do not know.
Mm.
Do you think Elizabeth Bennett would say the opposite, or would she agree with that?
Oh, that's a good question. I think she'd probably agree with that.
But the nature of her agreeing with that seems to me like it would be different. I think she'd be,
yes.
It's almost like she'd be answering a different question. She'd be answering to the affirmative, but there's a slightly different question.
Earlier, or 200, right? 200 years earlier. No, 150 years earlier, right? And so the expectations of what a good match would look like would be so different. I mean, she mm-hmm. does want to know Mr. Dorsey. She makes comments like, oh, I can see we haven't gotten to the point yet where I can make fun of him about this. She does want to know him. She does want to have that close relationship with him. I doubt that Elizabeth Bennet is much more likely to throw around the term soulmate than Margaret is, but I don't know that Elizabeth would have tossed it around either.
So there's a long passage in chapter 20 that the end of chapter 19 and the beginning of chapter 20, where Forster kind of waxes poetic about the nature of love. And it's kind of fascinating how he structures it, because you have this whole conversation with Helen, right? Where she's trying to convince Margaret not to do it. And they're comparing Margaret and Helen are kind of comparing Margaret's relationship with Mr. Wilcox to Helen's earlier, you know, fling with Paul. And the conversation ends super abruptly. There's no sense of closure to the conversation whatsoever, at least as far as the part of it that we are included in. And it ends with Margaret saying, "Rubbish!" exclamation point. And then it says there was a long silence during which the tide returned into Poole Harbor. And then we get this whole thing about the water creeping over the mud flats towards the gorse and the blackened heather. And this all the stuff about England's geography and topography and stuff, with the reference to the jewel and the silver sea, the reference to Shakespeare and all that. And then we get the chapter ends sort of suddenly, and then we get chapter 20, and then this is where we get Margaret thinking about the nature of love. And I want to know if you think that what she's saying here about the nature of love is consistent, or where it falls into this sort of continuum of romance from lowercase r to capital R. So Angelina, would you mind reading that first chapter or the first paragraph on chapter 20?
Yes, sure. Margaret had often wondered at the disturbance that takes place in the world's waters when love, who seems so tiny a pebble, slips in. Whom does love concern beyond the beloved and the lover? Yet his impact deluges 100 shores. No doubt the disturbance is really the spirit of the generations, welcoming the new generation and chafing against the ultimate fate, which holds all the seas in the palm of her hand. But love cannot understand this. He cannot comprehend another's infinity. He is conscious only of his own. Flying sunbeam, falling rose, pebble that asks for one quiet plunge below the fretting interplay of space and time. He knows that he will survive at the end of things and be gathered by fate as a jewel from the slime and be handed with admiration round the assembly of the gods. Men did produce this, they will say, and saying they will give men immortality. But meanwhile, what agitations meanwhile? The foundations of property and propriety are laid bare, twin rocks. Family pride flounders to the surface, puffing and blowing and refusing to be comforted. Theology, vaguely ascetic, gets up a nasty groundswell. Then the lawyers are aroused, cold brood, and creep out of their holes. They do what they can. They tidy up property and propriety, reassure theology and family pride. Half guineas are poured on the troubled waters. The lawyers creep back. And it all has gone well. Love joins one man and woman together in matrimony.
Okay, now.
Man, that's good.
Okay, that's now, really, really fine.
I wanted to read these in reverse order on purpose. Because, so we get the metaphors that he's using here of love as a jewel from the slime or gathered up by fate. And then also the idea of the disturbance that takes place in the world's waters when love, who seems so tiny a pebble, slips in. So this deluging 100 shores and all that. Okay, let's, now we have that in place. Tim, why don't you read the last paragraph of chapter 19? Because what Forrester does here is it's my favorite thing we've read so far, the way he is ending and beginning these chapters, like the way he's bracketing these
conversations. And he began 19 the same way.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that, but we're running out of time. So we'll just talk about this for now. Go ahead, Tim.
There was a long silence during which the tide returned into Cool Harbor. One would lose those, murmured Helen, apparently to herself. The water crept over the mud flaps toward the gorse and the blackened heather. Branksea Island lost its immense foreshores and became a somber episode of trees. Fromm was forced inward toward Dorchester, Stour, and Wimborne, Avon toward Salisbury, and over the immense displacement the sun presided, leading it to triumph ere he sank to rest. England was alive, throbbing through all her estuaries, crying for joy through the mouths of all the gulls, and the north wind, with contrary motion, blew stronger against her rising seas. What did it mean? For what end are her fair complexions, her changes of soil, her sinuous coast? Does she belong to those who have molded her and made her feared by other lands, or to those who have added nothing to her power, but have somehow seen her, seen the whole island at once, lying as a jewel in the silver sea, sailing as a ship of souls, with all the brave world's fleet accompanying her toward eternity?
So, as Angelina said, chapter 19 is bracketed by these two contemplations of, or at least uses of, the metaphor of England's geography. And then, so chapter 19 ends with this, and then chapter 20 begins with what you just read, Angelina. And so the way he ties that together in the beginning of chapter 20 is clearly meant to be tied back to 19. The jewel in the silver sea is, you know, that's not on accident. And the idea of like the tides coming in, that's in 19, is followed up in 20 by tying that into love doing that. So, Angelina, with that in mind, what is he trying to say here about love with these metaphors? Do either of you have any thoughts on that?
I do have some thoughts, and some new thoughts, actually, while we were reading this. I think, again, we're seeing the tension between the romantic and the pragmatic, right? And then even the water, the way it's going to shape the shore, and you know, this is that drip, drip, drip of erosion that you shape the shore. But then, you know, there's a lot of romance about the sea and England as an island and all that kind of stuff. And in 19, he makes the point that the most up-and-coming important cities are also the ugliest ones in the modern world. And so that brings that tension up again. So 20 starts then with the tension between capital R romance and pragmatism, because lawyers are not romantic. Hammering out the business end of a marriage agreement is not romantic, right? and there it is. She's in the midst of it, and she has this conversation with him. But I can't help also thinking that 19 and 20 are connected in another way, with that Helen says, look, all women lose their heads. That's why I kissed Paul. Margaret says, that's crazy. This is entirely different, right? And then, so then we have a very like chapter 20, very pragmatic. I'm going to hammer out the business end with Mr. Wilcox. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, she embarrasses Mr. Wilcox because she's so upfront about money issues, right? And she's very, this is entirely different. And then he kisses her and it's not romantic. And yet she couldn't help thinking this was like Paul. And I wasn't sure what to make of that when I first read it. But right now I'm thinking the kiss with Paul, Helen describes as she got caught up in the poetry of the kiss. It wasn't the kiss, it was the poetry of the kiss. And so I can't help but wonder if what's happening here is she has this very pragmatic chapter, right? And this marriage is going to be what it is. And then he kisses her and it's not romantic. But doggone it, if there wasn't poetry in that kiss anyway. Like, maybe a kiss is just always the unexpected mystery of it. Maybe a kiss is just always poetry. Yes. Maybe that's just the nature of it.
Yeah.
You know what I thought, Angelina, about that kiss? I think you're exactly right. There's this marriage of the pragmatic and let's call it the romantic. And the conversation between Mr. Wilcox and Margaret leading up to the kiss, I thought Mr. Wilcox is the happiest. He's the happiest monkey in the jungle right now. He is so pleased. And I think that he thinks that he has just merged with Margaret's soul. And I think Margaret, who is much more romantic than him, thought we were just talking business. And I think I wonder if Mr. Wilcox is like, no, honey, we were in love.
That is totally legitimate.
I was laughing when you said that doing the business side of a marriage agreement is not romantic. But I was thinking, well, there's probably some people for whom romantic.
So, all right. So then that just brings it up again, the tension between the Wilcoxes and the Schlegels. What is going to feel grand romantic to a Wilcox is not even going to pebble in the ocean to the Schlegels. I mean, that's true.
Can I narrow that down even further? Like, you could say the Wilcoxes and the Schlegels, but you could also just say, like, you have to narrow it down to the individual, right? Because even, you know,
yes, Margaret versus Helen.
Yeah, Margaret versus Ellen, or Mr. Wilcox and Mrs. Wilcox, you know, his late wife, or Paul and Charles. I mean, like, it's about the families, yes, because the families create context.
Yes.
But it's the individual as well. Like, two individuals are what, or who's, you know, how they feel about it is where it gets so complicated and that tension comes in. And figuring out how to, like, connect when you feel, figuring out how to connect about how you feel about each other when you express it and live it out in different ways is probably the hardest thing about one of the hardest things about any relationship, right? Because like my wife and I express how we feel about each other extremely differently. I mean, this is where they talk about the love languages stuff, but figuring out how to express that in ways that are meaningful to the other person, not just yourself.
Yeah, if your love language is balancing my checkbook ledger, you're gonna have to move
right
on.
Right.
But yeah, right, so like I feel I express affection one way, but I have to find a way to express my affection for my wife in a way that is meaningful to her, right? I can't just depend on I can't just focus on how I express it, right?
Yeah.
And that's where figuring out how to way to make the way we express our affections towards each other is one of the and connecting those together is the hardest part of any relationship, but especially a romantic relationship, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's true of friendship, like business relationships.
Absolutely,
Best friends, podcast hosts.
What? Who?
David's language is food. Unfortunately, Tim and I get none of that.
You guys, can I tell a story that is on this point? I will not use the names, but a couple that listens to this program, they got married. Oh gosh, I'm going to say it was 10 years ago. No, it was more than that. So it was 12 years ago. And I asked the husband, who's a longtime friend of mine, I said, so, you know, you've been married a few months now, like, you know, how's it going? And he said, it's great. I wish I had not waited so long to get married, because he was, you know, I think he was probably in his mid 30s when he got married. And, you know, he just loved his wife and they had a great honeymoon and they were just settling in together and he was so happy. And he said, you won't believe what happened. And I said, what? And he said, I was at work. And while I was at work, I completely forgot that I had forgotten to pay my mortgage 2 months in a row. And so I kind of like flew into this terror and I call my wife and I say, honey, I'm so embarrassed. I completely forgot to pay the mortgage 2 months in a row. And she said, I took care of it. And he said, what? And she said, yeah, I took care of it. I knew that you had forgotten. And so I just got out the checkbook and I wrote a check and I took care of it. And, you know, he hangs up the phone and he was just over the moon. And it made me laugh. That story remind me of Angelina. Like, if you're signed like the checkbook ledger, this is not the height of love. And I think that he would say the same thing. I think that he would say, you know, like, that's not what he got into the marriage for. That's not why he, you know, married his wife. But because she covered his weakness so adroitly, it was like the height of ecstasy for them. And I know there's so much. I mean, I think they've got a wonderful marriage as far as I can see. I think that she, like I said, the fact that she recognized, oh, this is just not his strength. Let me just take care of this.
Do you think it's possible that the merging of souls is more, to borrow Angelina's phrase, the merging of souls is more is less defined by the heights of romance, as you put it, Tim, that, or the heights of love or whatever you said, than it is by a million little things that make the connection stronger?
I can only speak as a sociologist on this matter, as a bachelor. My answer would be yes. That just seems to me like there has to be more. Again, I'm totally talking from an outsider. It seems like there's got to be more, but that seems like a pretty important prerequisite.
Okay, so I feel like I need to like define a bazillion terms here.
Yeah, I mean, you have literally 2 minutes, and I'm perfectly understand that I was oversimplifying.
Well, I don't mean to suggest that Mr. Wilcox doesn't feel he's in love. I think that he does. The point is that his understanding of what that means is so very different from hers. And when I talk about the merging of the souls, obviously anytime there's going to be like unity in a couple, and that can be very pragmatic, it's going to feel like we're one, right? And so that's going to happen. But when I talk about like somebody who's, again, capital R, romantic philosophy, they are not talking about, I'm looking for a partner in life. That is not the way a romantic looks at it, right? Mm-hmm. So when they're talking about the merging of two souls, it would be like, I'm going to plummet the depths of understanding. I'm going to know you and see you and understand. You're going to know and see me. And that's just not the world that Mr. Wilcox interacts with, right? Like, Forrester makes the point several times of, well, I know my worker and I don't really know anything about him, and that's fine. His business is his business. I know he's my good worker, right? And he's really comfortable with knowing people in that way, where, you know, Helen and Margaret want to sit down Leonard and give him the third degree. Like, we want to know every nook and cranny of your soul. Why were you walking? You know, and he's like, leave me alone.
So what it means to be in love with someone they view differently is what you're saying?
Yes, there's two very different. And again, Forrester's holding all these things in tension. They have a very highly idealized view. That's why Helen feels Margaret has betrayed them. He knows Margaret doesn't have those kinds of feelings about Mr. Wilcox.
I agree. Yeah.
But again, Forrester is not, he's not flipping the coin on either one of these. And I'm interested to see what is this mystery he's referring to, this unexpected mystery. Perhaps she will be more deeply in love than she imagined she could be. And perhaps he will also come to a place that he never thought he could in a relationship either.
And thus maybe those lowercase r things will lead to the merging of souls.
I mean, I completely agree that, see, that's what's so interesting. Margaret thinks the kiss came out of nowhere and wasn't led up to. I completely agree that Mr. Wilcox is like feeling like a 14-year-old boy. Like,
yeah, he's absolutely, just
beyond himself.
He's
probably thinking about it for 4 hours, right?
Yes. Absolutely. And just like, oh, God, I can't take it anymore. I have to kiss this woman. And she's just like, where did that come from?
Yes.
You have to read me a poem or something. You're not doing this right.
Yeah, we have been doing business. We haven't been wandering along through a field looking at the flowers. And
all of those fantastically hilarious anti-romantic elements in that chapter, right? Like, they're on the walk in the boardwalk. They're this newly engaged couple, and they're going to be planning their wedding day. And she says too loud, so when are you going to marry me? And then these boys start snickering at them. I mean, that was just fantastic.
Yep.
I mean, they're basically saying that 1910 version of Get a Room, you know? It's fantastic. And he's like, I would beg you to remember there's a lady present.
I
to call the police if we have further outbursts.
Yes, then, exactly.
And you could just see, like, really what would happen is before the police could get there is Margaret would go over there and hit them with an umbrella or something.
Yeah.
She's competent enough to take care of herself, right?
Well, yeah, she doesn't want him to walk her home. Again, she misses that that's a romantic gesture on his part, right?
Yes, right.
Like,
right.
I've backpacked in the mountains, whatever. I can walk home.
Yeah. His response is something like, and if I have my way, you never shall again.
Exactly. Which for him is this like chivalrous romantic gesture.
Absolutely.
Yeah. She's just like, what is wrong with you? I have legs at work.
But she also wasn't, it also says that she's not like offended by it.
Nope. She's not offended by any of the things about him that Helen is. So that, that's interesting too.
Yeah, Helen would be like, you know, how dare you? They're trading on something about Margaret. I shouldn't have even brought it up. Go ahead, Tim. Say something.
I actually do. This is going to segue us away, David. But I have an observation that I would love for us to take up in one of the subsequent podcasts on the book. Have
trading
you guys
on Margaret's
noticed?
Reputation as an emancipated woman.
Ooh,
oh, nice, David.
Yeah, that's the line. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
Have you guys noticed how when Forrester has a conversation between two people, how negligent he is in describing the other people that are around that conversation or the setting of that conversation? Meaning, there were a few times during the chapters that we read where, I don't know, you know, Margaret would be talking to someone and a third party would just pop up and say a few words. And I was like, wait a second. We didn't even know that. I didn't even know that person was in the room. Have you guys noticed this? Or is this just me?
I did not notice that.
Oh gosh.
Maybe I'm not a good reader.
Yeah, that's obviously the conclusion we're all going to draw right now.
What did we discover on today's podcast? Well, Angelina's not a good reader.
Also, she spews nonsense and admits it.
And loves it.
Well, no, I did notice, like, I find some of the conversations disorienting in how he presents them, which seems purposeful. I don't think he's, like, just a terrible writer of dialogue. But Tim, that's going to have to be your final thought because we're running out of time and I'm going to ask Angelina to give a final thought now. And you have 25 seconds, Angelina.
Oh, okay. I can't think of anything else. I'm just enjoying it. I'm curious to see what's going to happen. I'm really enjoying it.
Yep. Likewise. All right. Well, thanks to everyone who's been listening. Thanks for everyone who's been supporting us through Patreon. If you want to learn more about how you can do that, you can go to patreon.com/closereads. Thank you for continuing to converse with us over on the Facebook page. I don't think that any of us have any chance or capability of keeping up with all the conversations going on over there. So we'll just continue to participate as we can. And for the rest of it, be a fly on the wall.
Not at all, but I know Tim feels the same way because we've talked about this. It's cool to watch them take over the conversation.
Yeah, I was just going
to
say.
Super awesome to see them. And to see friendships developing and people meeting and talking and just like, I feel like we just basically present appetizers and then they are off and running with the rest of that meal, you know?
Absolutely.
I don't know that anybody needs to hear from us any more than we already have the floor. So
exactly.
It might be a little bit of overkill. So, thanks to everyone for the community that you've been creating and that we're just grateful to be a part of. So I guess that's it for Angelina Stanford and for Tim McIntosh and for all of us here at Circe. I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening to Close Reads on the Circe Institute Podcast Network. We'll talk to you next week.